Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. I made a strong hand motion to get us going there, and you looked at me funny.
Yeah, you were really loud, too.
I'm really into it, man. I'm good. I'm good.
You seem excited.
Yeah, I got some stuff going on that's exciting and not at all anything our listeners will be interested in, but
maybe on Bless Their Hearts. Maybe listeners of Bless Their Hearts. If you didn't know, Jamie and I have what I would call a comedy show, or at least the show where we catch up on our lives.
It's listed as comedy, yeah.
And it's called Bless Their Hearts. If you're not familiar, please check it out. We're having a blast over there.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And yeah, I have some shenanigans of car shopping. That's the basic gist that I'll be sharing.
I have an embarrassing story
next week
that will come up in a couple of weeks on, I found out that there's a, I was confusing a nickel and a quarter, and there's a long story to that.
I have so many questions that I'll get to
check that out
on Bless Their Hearts. Before we get going, I want to give a big thanks to a new review that came in over on Apple Podcasts. Jay Witt B says, do yourself a favor and listen. These guys do a great job telling stories and adding in their own commentary. They're very thorough and add their own special twist. Run, don't walk to listen to them.
Oh, thank you.
That's very nice. In case you have forgotten, through the end of March, we're doing a review giveaway. If you enter a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or social media, you will be entered to win some really awesome prizes.
Yeah. Guys, I also want to mention Patreon. You can visit patreon.com, and when you're there, search for True Crime Cast, and you will find, if you join one of our tiers, which is the lowest one is $3 a month, you have access to nearly 80 bonus episodes that will only be available to Patreon members. We also put up our Tuesday and Friday shows a day early and ad-free, so go check that out. You will not regret it.
Probably worth it just to skip the ads, in my opinion, but we appreciate everybody over there, and certainly consider that if you have not already, but we have a doozy here today that you don't have to join Patreon for.
This is my favorite kind of case. Just a good old mystery.
I think, and I have some reasons for thinking this is one of your favorites that we'll get into later. But yeah, this is the kind of case that I know you get into, and I'm really excited to get your take on as well. So why don't you go ahead and get us rolling?
We're going to go back a little ways. We're going to go back to the afternoon of January 2nd, 1935. Think about how much different the world was then. I mean, that's almost 100 years ago
now. It is. That's crazy to think, because when we were growing up, that was 50 years ago. But yeah, Now it's almost 100 because we're getting old.
I mean, just to put things in a time frame of my life, my grandfather wasn't born yet, and he has since passed away. My great-grandmother, his mom, was like 2 years away from having my grandfather.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that puts things into a perspective
for me. In between World War I and World War II, we're in the Great Depression.
Yeah, things are great in America.
Not ideal.
Well, on this afternoon, a man walked into a motel. Actually, it was a hotel, and that was called Hotel President, and that was in Kansas City, Missouri. What a great name.
It really is. That's a strong name, and I feel like it. You know, if you just told me you were going to stay there, I would assume it's one of the, like, an exclusive, prestigious type place. And it's in Kansas City, where they have Jack Stack Barbecue, which is my favorite, one of my two favorite restaurants in the country.
Yeah. And this was at least somewhat of a high rise. At least they had multiple floors, because when the man checked in, he asked for two things. He wanted an interior floor room, and he wanted it several floors up, and he would only be staying for one night. This is, you know, I can't imagine that they had elevators back then. So to stay several floors up, like, did the dude just want some privacy? Because it doesn't seem like a request that would have been convenient back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been. And what is the payoff of having an interior room and not having a window? Just so people can't see you through the window? Is this a paranoid thing? Being several floors up? I mean, I don't know.
I could think of,
not a big deal to me.
For me, if I know that I get to sleep in the morning, and there's like, is the sun going to come in and wake me up kind of thing, maybe I would want an interior room. But regardless, that's what he asked for. And his name was Ronald T. Owen. And he gave them an address that he belonged to Los Angeles. So he was quite a ways from home in 1935. He was dressed well. He was wearing a dark overcoat and had no bags with him. So a little strange to be traveling all the way from L.A. with literally nothing.
Yeah, I'd say very few people check into a hotel without something, whether it's even like a backpack or even a briefcase. He had nothing.
Yeah, so the staff noted that he had a scar on his temple, and then he had cauliflower ear. Now, this is something that is usually seen on boxers, professional wrestlers. It takes a lot to make your ear have this type of shape, but basically it's from smashing your ear over and over and over again, because that's what wrestlers do.
And there's never been a more accurate name for a condition. Like, yeah, it looks like your ear is some type of vegetable.
Yeah. And this man appeared to be in his early 20s.
Randolph Probst, who was the bellhop, showed Ronald to his room, and he was staying in room 1046. On the way up to the room, Ronald told Randolph that he had stayed at a nearby Muehlbach hotel the night before and that the rates were way too high. Reports would later show that in that hotel, somebody had signed in using the name Don Kelso. Randolph watched Ronald as he unpacked a toothbrush and a comb from his pockets. So he got everything out, put his toothbrush, toothpaste up. So he did have at least some toiletries that we know of. But that's all. That's all that he seemed to have with him. So the bellhop left the room and soon after that saw Ronald leaving through the lobby to depart from the hotel.
Shortly after that, one of the hotel maids named Mary came in and went to room 1046. Ronald answered the door and then let her in to clean. And when Mary entered, she noticed that the shades had not been drawn and that there was only one dim lamp that was left on. Well, Jamie, earlier we noted that his request was to have an interior room. So I guess they weren't able to oblige.
Yeah, that is what he asked for. Obviously, he had a window, so maybe it just wasn't a corner room, so it didn't have too many windows. But yeah, there were shades, and that's going to come up a few times.
I stay in a hotel in Columbus, Ohio once a year, and my favorite room is the corner room because it's just so lit, and I don't know, you can see the whole city.
5 minutes ago, you said you'd rather stay in a room with no windows to get sleep.
That's fair, but I have to wake up early for this.
Okay.
So it's not a vacation.
It helps. It helps. I get it.
She said that during his stay, this man seemed either worried or was afraid of something. After she had been cleaning for a few minutes, Ronald put his overcoat on and then he brushed his hair. And as he was leaving, he looked at Mary and asked her if she could leave the room unlocked because he was expecting a friend to come over in just a few minutes. At around 4 p.m. that same day, Mary came back to room 1046 with some fresh towels. The door was unlocked from earlier, and when she entered, Ronald was laying on top of the still-made bed, fully clothed. So the bed was still made, and Ronald was laying on top of it. There was a note on his bedside table that read, "Don, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait."
Now, remember, Don was the name of the person checked into the hotel, the other hotel in town where Ronald says that he had been staying at. And from the sound of this, John, this hotel had really good service. She came and cleaned, and she's already brought fresh towels, and he's not been there for even a day. That's top-notch stuff there.
It is the hotel president.
It is. The next morning, Mary came back. This time, the door was locked. Based on the way the locks operated at this particular hotel, if a guest had locked the door from the inside of the room, Mary wouldn't be able to unlock it, which people who enjoy privacy may like that. Seems kind of like a safety hazard, but that's how they rolled at this hotel. But Mary was able to unlock the door, which means it was locked from the outside. This led Mary to believe that Ronald wouldn't be in the room because in order to lock it from the outside, you had to be outside the room. But when she got in there, he was inside, sitting in the dark, exactly where he had been the previous afternoon, on top of the bed with the bed made. While Mary was cleaning, she heard the phone ring. She heard Ronald answered it, and he said, "No, Don, I don't want to eat. I'm not hungry. I just had breakfast. No, I'm not hungry." So Don was checked into this other hotel, or maybe Ronald was staying with Don in this other hotel, but the phone did ring and she heard Ronald's side of this conversation. He made some small talk with Mary as she finished cleaning, and when she was done, Mary left him in the room. Just like the day before, she came back with some fresh towels around 4 p.m., and inside the room, she heard two men arguing. So she knocked instead of just going in. There was a really loud voice yelling, and she didn't think it was Ronald's voice, who asked who it was. She said, "This is the housekeeper. I have fresh towels." And the voice yelled back, "We don't need any." So that was her cue to go away. I'm sure this happened quite often for her, but she walked away knowing that she had taken all the towels out of that room when she cleaned it in the morning. So they said they didn't need any towels, but they didn't have any at all. So even though she sometimes sent away for a few minutes, this was a unique situation to remember.
At 7 a.m. the following morning, there was a switchboard operator named Della Ferguson, and she was starting her shift at the hotel. She was preparing to wake someone up in room 1046 by doing a wake-up call, but when she went to do that, she saw that the light was on, indicating that the phone in that room was off the hook. I feel like this is just such an old-timey thing to say, but that hotel had an operator's board inside the hotel to connect and take calls and all that. So that was interesting.
We're currently worried about AI taking our jobs. Machines actually did replace this person entirely.
Yeah. So she got in touch with the bellhop named Randolph and asked him to go up to the room and see what was going on with the phone. And when he got up to room 1046, the door was locked and there was a do not disturb sign hanging from the doorknob. So this is kind of an issue. So Randolph loudly knocked several times, and then he heard a voice inside that told him to come in. Well, like I said, the door was locked, so he had to continue to knock on the door. And then again, the voice yelled out, but this time the voice said to turn the lights on. Well, Randolph got frustrated because he couldn't get in there. He couldn't do any of the things the guy was telling him to do. And he just yelled back into the room to say, "Hang up the phone," and then he left. So the bellhop told Della, the operator, basically, that the man in the room was likely drunk and to wait another hour and then we could try this again or do the wake-up call if he actually hung up the phone.
Yeah, so at 8:30 a.m., the phone was still off the hook. So for our listeners that didn't really grow up with corded phones in your home, off the hook, it made a pretty distinctive sound, at least when we were growing up. It may not have in 1935, but just to play this really quickly for you, in case you're curious what an off the hook phone sounds like. And it would just do this.
Yeah. Now, like you said, I don't know if this was the case in 1935, but when we were growing up, if the phone accidentally got left off the hook, that's what you would hear, and it would not stop until you put it back on the hook. I don't know that was happening at this point.
So like I said, it was still off the hook at 8:30 in the morning, and a new bellhop was on call. His name was Harold Pike, and he was sent up to the room to check. The do not disturb sign was still there and the door was still locked, but Harold had a key and he let himself in. Inside the dark room, Harold saw Ronald lying on top of his bed, completely in the nude. Harold said he appeared to be passed out drunk. He thought he was definitely asleep. That dim light from the hallway showed that there were dark spots around him on the bed. Maybe he had spilled something, had some bodily messes in the bed, but Harold didn't want to disturb him. Instead of turning on a light, Harold simply went to where the phone had been on the floor because it was knocked over, and he hung the phone up to allow the switchboard operator to see that it was hung up at that time, and then Harold left the room.
Two more hours would go by, and at 10:30 a.m., another operator said that the phone in room 1046 was off the hook again. So this time, Randolph was sent back up to see what was going on this time. The doorknob still had the do not disturb sign on. You know, poor guy just wants to be left alone, and this is just over and over again.
Well, maybe you just leave the phone on the hook, and people leave you alone.
Yeah, so Randolph knocked again. No one answered, but he used his key to get in. When he opened the door, Randolph found Ronald on his knees and elbow, 2 feet from the door, with a bloody head. Randolph turn the light on, put the phone on the hook because that's priority number one for this guy. And then when he did that, he saw that there was blood on the bed and the walls and the ceiling in the main bedroom and bathroom. Randolph ran downstairs to get the assistant manager, who called the police and the doctor.
So I know you love to put yourself in people's shoes. Put yourself in Randolph's shoes here. This guy has been a problem for you. You've had to go up there. He's yelled at Mary. He's yelled at you to do stuff you couldn't do. They've had to go take the phone and put it back on the hook a couple times. You're probably getting frustrated with this customer. So you rush in and then you notice there's blood everywhere and you go from frustrated and angry to panicky, I would think, really quickly. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about what happened when authorities arrived and what we actually know about Ronald's death.
We've only communicated via text.
Don't tell him it's a wrong number. Have some fun with it. Play along.
You don't know who you have really been messing with.
Why would you have a duffel bag full of cash?
You're not so big and bad when you're not behind your phone.
Next time you may not make it out alive.
You don't work here.
Stop, Nick.
Freeze. Drop the bag and get on the ground.
One thing at a time. First, the cash.
You know you're not the only option I have, right?
You're behind this whole thing, aren't you?
No, this wasn't supposed to happen.
It's over for you.
No, 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 no.
Why is this happening?
From the makers of True Crime Cast, find the fictional mystery Left on Dead wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
So after Randolph found Ronald in the floor, bloody, with blood all over the room, he ran downstairs to get the assistant manager. He got him. The two ran as fast as they could back up to room 1046. But when they got there, they couldn't open the door. When Randolph left, Ronald was on his knees and his elbow, and he had fallen over when Randolph left and was blocking the door with his body.
So he was still alive.
Yeah.
He wasn't dead.
Yeah, he just moved. He wasn't dead, but still, obviously, there's blood everywhere, so there's a panic. They called the police. The police came up, and then a doctor from Kansas City General Hospital came up. And what they found when they got there was Ronald in the bathtub with his legs sticking out.
He's moved again.
We've seen him laying fully clothed, passed out on the bed, laying naked on the bed, laying in the floor all bloody. And now he's in the bathtub. According to the doctor's statement, there was a clothesline that had been tied around Ronald's neck, ankles, and wrists, and he had been stabbed in the chest multiple times, which, with that much blood on the wall and the ceiling, I think a stabbing is really the only way you're going to get that. His neck had some bruising, indicated that he had probably also been strangled. His lung had been punctured from a beating, and his skull was fractured by at least three different blows to the head. The doctor would cut off the ropes from Ronald's wrist and ask him who did this to him. Keep in mind, he's still alive, which is baffling given everything I just said. He mumbled back to the doctor, "Nobody." I would think, no matter the circumstances, if somebody did this to you, you'd want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Obviously, Ronald didn't.
Yeah, and I mean, I've even wondered, like, was he coherent enough to really understand the question? But the dude's getting around a little bit, you know?
He is. And they asked him what caused his injuries. Ronald said that he just tripped and fell and hit his head on the bathtub.
That doesn't explain the stab wounds.
Or the rope. Or the cracked ribs and punctured lungs. So the doctor asked Ronald if he was trying intentionally to hurt himself, and Ronald said no. After that, Ronald lost consciousness, which I think gives Creed to your idea there that maybe he wasn't really in it at that time anyway. They took him to the hospital, and he went into a coma. This coma was something he would never wake up from and died the next morning.
So based on the dried blood, the doctor estimated that Ronald's initial wounds were 6 to 7 hours old and then had been inflicted well before Ronald or Randolph's first visit that morning. They believed that the phone kept falling off the hook that many times because he was trying to call for help. And police searched the room and found that everything was gone. All the man's clothing, his belongings, everything was missing. Even down to the soap, shampoo, and towels that were provided by the hotel seemed to be missing from that room. And, you know, we have a stabbing, but there were no knives. And then coupled with the clothesline, this ruled out suicide because clearly the things that inflicted this injury were no longer in the room. All that remained was an unsmoked cigarette and a glass with 4 fingerprints, and they were believed to be a woman's fingerprints. And these prints did not match Ronald or anyone else at the hotel staff. And the autopsy showed that he died from the wounds that were inflicted on him. There wasn't any poisoning or anything like that. He died from basically being stabbed, beaten, and bound.
And just go back to some of this, right? So when Randolph first came up there, or when Mary first came up, rather, there were 2 men, and somebody that wasn't Ronald yelled at her. Then Randolph went up and there was another person in the room and the doors locked this entire time. When they first put the phone back on the hook, he was on the bed naked and there was blood everywhere. And then they come back and he's tied up, come back again, and he's in the bathtub with nobody having ever seen another person, but they did hear another voice in there. Now, it didn't take long to figure out that this man's real name was not Ronald Owen. There was nobody from LA with that name, and that's where he gave his address from. So this body was kept and displayed at McGillie Memorial Hospital, where thousands of locals came to see it without anybody being able to identify him. Kansas City police then launched a national search to try to figure out who this guy is. They got in touch with police departments all over the country, asking if there was a missing person who fit the description of this Ronald Owen, or at least that was his fake name, of course. And especially they pointed out this hexagon-shaped scar on his temple that we mentioned earlier. After some local news coverage, the story was picked up by radio and newspapers across the U.S. And then on March 3rd, which is almost 2 months after he died, the local Kansas City News announced that the funeral home was finally going to bury the man in the city's Potter's Field. That day, the funeral home got a phone call from a man asking them to hold up, asking them not to have the funeral yet because they wanted to send money for a grave and to have a service at the Memorial Park Cemetery there in Kansas City. The funeral director asked the caller if he knew why Ronald had been killed, and the caller said he hadn't played the game fair, and cheaters usually get what's coming to them, and hung up. That sounds, John, like he owed somebody money, he screwed somebody over. He had made the wrong person angry, was what I get from that. On March 23rd, the funeral home received $25 in an envelope, which today that's like $500. So it is a decent amount of money to help out with expenses. They don't know who sent it, and it was wrapped up in a newspaper. The day they actually had the funeral, there was a delivery of 13 American Beauty roses to go on the grave with a card reading, "Love Forever, Louise." The funeral was attended only by police detectives and a minister. Nobody else came to visit, and nobody had claimed this man to be their own, at least publicly, and given their name.
Images of the dead man continued to appear in newspapers and magazines around the country. A year after the murder, a woman named Ruby Ogletree of Birmingham, Alabama, saw an issue of the American Weekly, which was an article about the case, and she immediately recognized the photo as her son, who was named Artemis Ogletree. Now, Artemis was born in Florida in 1915, and he was one of 3 children, and during his childhood, he had an accident with some hot grease, which left him with a hexagon scar over his ear. In 1934, which was a year before the murder, 19-year-old Artemis left his family in Birmingham to hitchhike across the country with his friend who was named Joe Simpson. Joe says they made it all the way to California, and then they went their separate ways. Artemis continued to send letters to his family while he was traveling, and they wired him money from time to time. And that's why Ruby really had no idea that her son was dead. She was still getting letters from Artemis after the murder in the hotel.
Yeah. Just,
I mean, you can't let that money stop, you know?
I mean, but who was there to receive it? That's the big question, right? So after she saw this article, she called Kansas City PD and provided them with enough information to let them know that she was for real and she could identify this man and that he was, in fact, Artemis Ogletree. But this raised even more questions because early in 1935, Ruby got one of those letters and it was postmarked from Chicago. Now, she initially found the letter suspicious because Artemis always handwrote his letters. That was just the way he did it. This letter, however, was typed, which was also weird since she didn't think that Artemis knew how to type. Now, again, if you don't know what a busy signal sounds like, you may not know what a typewriter is. But basically, this letter was typed and Ruby didn't think Artemis knew how to do that. It was also a higher level of vocabulary than Artemis usually used. It's not necessarily a knock on his intelligence. Some very smart people don't use big words, but the person who wrote this letter did. And then in May of 1935, which was 5 months after Artemis was killed in this hotel, Ruby got another letter that was labeled from Artemis saying that he was going to go to Europe. She then received a second letter saying that his ship was sailing out that day and that he was leaving from New York, which was where the last two letters were postmarked from.
Then there was an even stranger twist. In August of 1935, Ruby received a telephone call from a man in Memphis, Tennessee. And it was a man who claimed that Artemis saved his life in a fight. So this caller told this mom, Ruby, that Artemis couldn't call his mother himself because he was now living in Egypt. So the man told Ruby that Artemis could not write to her either because he also lost his thumb in a fight where he had saved the life of the caller. He also said Artemis had been married to a wealthy woman and was doing very well. This is crazy, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of times when people lie, they tend to try to make everything too detailed. And I think he lost his thumb in a fight, so he can't write you a letter is a bit telling that you're not telling the truth.
Yeah. Ruby talked to this guy for at least half an hour, and she noticed that he spoke wildly and irrationally, but he did seem to know Artemis. She told the police the name of the man that she spoke with, and that name has never been made public. But when police looked into the story, there was absolutely no record of Artemis Ogletree ever sailing to Egypt, nor was the U.S. Embassy in Cairo able to find any evidence that he had ever been there.
Yeah, so again, to recap, he left Alabama, supposedly moved to California, died in Kansas City, then she got a letter from Chicago, two letters from New York, and a phone call from Memphis, Tennessee, saying he was in Cairo. That's some where in the world's Carmen Sandiego stuff there.
I feel like this is like a, oh man, one of those murder mystery movies that I watch with my wife from this time frame. Like, yeah, crazy stuff.
Kansas City Chief of Detectives T.J. Higgins followed a lead to New York, and he said that he was satisfied that this crime was committed by a convicted killer named Joseph Martin. Now, Martin was in prison already for killing Oliver George Senecal. He shot Oliver, then dismembered him, cutting off a tattoo, and then stuffed his nude body into a steamer trunk bound for Memphis. The trunk got held up in Penn Station where the body was discovered. After he was arrested for this crime, it was discovered that Martin had served time in several prisons and had been admitted to two insane asylums, another word we don't use anymore, they're mental hospitals, but he had been admitted to one in Birmingham, Alabama. The records noted that he had escaped prison and he had a history of homosexuality. Martin also had several aliases, including Donald Kelso. Think back to the hotels. Don Kelso is on the registry of the Muhlenberg Hotel that Ronald said he came from, and he was yelling at somebody named Don. And that's the main reason that Higgins was convinced that there was this guy. They claimed handwriting for Martin, identified him as the same guy that signed into the hotel as Donald Kelso with Ogletree, but the handwriting didn't actually match once later investigators looked back at it. The FBI reviewed it in 1950, and they said it was concluded that the signature of Donald Kelso on the hotel registration card was not written by Joseph Martin. So the prime suspect in this case, who, again, the sheriff said, I'm convinced it's him, 15 years later was completely cleared of this crime and the case went cold.
Well, I mean, that was going to be my first question as to, like, who do you have to look at first? And they did that and cleared him. Ruby had written several letters to the Kansas City Police Department saying that she suspected her son's friend, Joe Simpson, was the one responsible. And she spent years trying to meet up with this man herself in Birmingham, but she was stood up several times. Police told Ruby that they actually interviewed Joe and cleared him. But she finally was able to talk to this guy in December of 1939 and became even more certain that he was the one who killed her son. So after that, I guess, interview or after that meetup, she wrote the Kansas City Police Department and said, quote, in talking with the boy, Joe Simpson, I was reasonably convinced that he is the person that talked to me from Memphis, Tennessee, 7 months after my son was killed. Now, Jamie, help me remember, what was the phone call from Memphis about?
In the phone call from Memphis, whoever called her said that Artemis had saved their life in a fight. He now lived in Egypt with a rich wife and lost his thumb.
And she talked to this guy for 30 minutes at least. Well, she said that Joe told her that he believed the case would never be broken because there were absolutely no clues, and that the Kansas City basically, quote, will boast of it being the perfect crime, end quote. So he's saying can't be solved. The police have nothing, and this is like the perfect crime because everything was gone from the room. There was nothing there. She said that he laughed and said that it is the perfect crime, and they'll never get the ones who killed him. So that's a kind of an interesting use of language there. He said the ones that killed him and not the person who killed him.
Yeah, and he also didn't say whoever it was that killed him, or I don't think they'll ever catch the person. It sounds like he's pretty definite in knowing what happened and that nobody else will ever find out.
This next part is awesome. So during the conversation, Ruby said that she looked Joe in the eye. I would know the voice that talked to me from Memphis. And she said upon saying that, he turned red, he dropped his eyes, and he was nervous.
Does him calling from Memphis mean he's the man that killed Artemis, though? I mean, I think it gives a big clue because of the ridiculous lies and the fact that it was after his death and probably trying to cover it up. But, I mean, it's not a direct tie. But I see where she could get in that direction. In 2003, somebody got in touch with a local historian at the Kansas City Public Library saying that they had information about Ogletree's death. They said they had been helping inventory the belongings of an elderly person who had recently passed away. In the boxes, they found old newspaper clippings about the Ogletree murder. The caller also said they found an item that tied the late owner to the murder. Now, the caller, when they called, would not identify themselves, and they wouldn't say what this item was. And this case is still unsolved. That was the least gratifying section of we've ever talked about. Because it sounds like we got who it is. This elderly person died, and they left behind a weapon, and it ties them to it. But I'm not going to tell you anything else. Click.
Yeah, and there's so many. So I wish I'd have taken notes, because there's so many questions, like, who paid for this kid's funeral? You know, like, why did that happen?
Yeah, they sent flowers from somebody named Louise. Why would you do these things? Why would you continue to expose yourself if you're trying to get away with murder?
Is it because you feel guilty that you murdered this guy? I mean, yeah, like, what was the motive there anyway? Just so many questions. And, you know, I think it's pretty safe to say at this point, we'll never know.
Yeah, and I hate that. That's one of my... I really spend time thinking about every unsolved case. Can it be solved? And this one's almost a hard no. And the reason I thought you'd be excited about this one, John, is because it's kind of the locked door scenario, right? Like we talked about with Ellen Greenberg. She was killed and the door was locked from the inside. And that's kind of what we see here from Ogletree, even though he is moving around. And this goes back to, I've heard you talk about Edgar Allan Poe before, and this is like the murders in the Rue Morgue, right? Like, nobody ever saw the man in this room. Yes, they heard voices. They heard him talking to somebody named Don. They know somebody did call the room, so he is communicating with someone, but the room is locked when they go up there every single time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, gosh, at the beginning of the story, I was suspicious of the bellhops. The first guy that went up there sounded a little frustrated because he thought he was dealing with a drunk guy. The second guy goes up and, well, I mean, the first time, right? Like, he's in the room. He's obviously coherent enough to talk a little bit. The second time somebody goes up, he's laying there naked, like, apparently. The third time, it's the first guy again, and this time he's found beaten to death. So did the second guy just get tired of all this shenanigans and just beat this guy and then took everything out of the room?
I would hope that they tried to clear those guys. And, of course, this isn't nowadays, right? If you go into a hotel room now, you scan your card, and there's a record saying you went in the room. Back then, we're just using keys. So yeah. we don't have the ability to track who went in and when, but we do know that he had to unlock the door to go in, hang up the phone, and then check on the bloody person that's tied up this case in that order.
Yeah. This case reminds me of Bob Saget too. I mean, you mentioned some other cases. Like, I don't think this guy accidentally fell and hit his head, whereas that is
and a stabbed himself a bunch of times.
Right. Yeah. But it's like, you got this guy laying in the motel room that's locked, and what happened? You know, yeah. It's going to be a mystery.
Yeah. He goes from the door, he falls over and blocks the door. Or was somebody still in the room when Randolph went in, and then when he came back, he was in the bathtub? So was somebody else, did they go put him in the bathtub and then leave somehow? Was there a goal there? Was there some exit through the window of that particular room? Is that why he was asking for a particular type of room? There are just so many questions about what he was doing in Kansas City, who he was actually communicating with. And those are things that are so far gone, we're never going to be able to know.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And honestly, before we started researching it, I'd never heard about this one. So this was a story that I enjoyed because it was so new.
It was new. And it is, like you said, it's a straight out of Sherlock Holmes type mystery. Unfortunately, Sherlock was not in Kansas City in 1935.
I was trying to think of the writer's name that my wife loves, and it's Agatha Christie. There was no poison in this one, but it was definitely a whodunit.
It is very much a whodunit, and we don't know, and we probably won't know. But we would love to hear your opinions. If you think it was one of the bellhops, if you believe the mom, if you believe Ruby, that it was his friend that set out for California with him, or it was the person that said that essentially he made the wrong people mad. So a lot of options there, but everybody pretty much is dead and gone. Now, the person who called, that was in 2003. That was just 20 years ago. Maybe that person knows. Maybe that person is listening to this podcast.
Maybe.
Hit us up.
Maybe they're dead by now.
TrueCrimeCast@gmail.com.
Tom has a way of running away from us.
Trying to solve some crimes. It's a little too deep, John. Guys, we really appreciate you and legitimately would love to know your thoughts here. This is the type of case that doesn't have a definitive angle to take. There are tons of different ones, and none of them are perfect. John, any final thoughts?
Nope. Don't forget to check us out on patreon.com. You'll find a lot of new content over there. But until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.